Okay, go. You have to speak loudly.
Okay. So just starting it off with a few ha'aros. It's interesting that the Mishnah, which lists the Seder Nachlos, the order of who inherits first and who inherits second, who inherits third, doesn't mention at all the husband. There's just a ba'al anywhere on the list. It just says that first goes the son, and then goes the father, and then goes the brothers, and then goes the grandfather and the uncle, etc. And the husband is nowhere on the list, which is an interesting omission. And similarly, the Gemara at the beginning of the Perek, when it discusses the sources for who comes first and who comes second, also seems to omit in the whole discussion about maybe the brother should come first and maybe the uncle, so whoever it is, the daughter should come first. It doesn't have any discussion at all but how we know that, let's say, the husband precedes all of these people. It just is totally omitted from the Gemara's discussion. And not only that, but from all of the later Mishnayos in the Perek, which discuss details of the halachos of Yerusha, there's no discussion at all about whether that applies equally to Yerusha of the husband, or whether it applies only to Yerusha, regular Yerusha of sons, daughters, fathers, brothers, uncles, etc. The question that points to, or that begs asking, is whether all of the halachos in the parak apply equally to a husband who's inheriting his wife, or whether the halachos in the parak apply only selectively to a husband who's inheriting. I'm thinking particularly of Yochanan ben Broka, that the person is able to decide, I want to give my Yerusha to this Yorish, to give more to one Yorish than to a second Yorish.
Meaning what? That the wife be able to say, I'm not going to give it to the husband, I'm going to give it to somebody else?
Right, so it's interesting. There's two hesitancies, both of which I don't really want to deal with explicitly. Rav Shach raises the question of what happens if a woman is married to two husbands, which is a theoretical, maybe even a practical possibility based on certain Mishnayos and Gemaras in Gittin and in Kiddushin. He's dealing with it more as a theoretical possibility, and he wants to know, or he raises in passing the question about whether the woman has the right to give more Yerusha to one husband and less to the other husband. And the Gemara itself also gives a possibility. It says, according to Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, it says a person can give to the second in line for Yerusha, not just to the first in line. So again, the question is, what happens if you have a husband and then a son? So can the woman choose to divert the Yerusha from her husband and give it to her son? Those are just questions that I'm raising, because the Gemara does not explicitly, nor do the Mishnayos.
Now what I don't understand exactly, because the Gemara talks about, like, with ben bein abani, bas bein abanos, basically they're equal kind of people. They're both dole, they both have
the same Yerusha. The Acher b'makom ben, or Acher b'makom bas, that means second in line. Meaning
we don't hold like that, right?
We don't hold like that. I'm just suggesting it theoretically. In general, we don't encourage women having two husbands either.
No, I understand, but I'm just saying conceptually that she should be able to give it, if you said a husband and a son.
Right.
Even that shouldn't.
I mean, he's just saying there is an opinion in the Gemara, and within that tzad, he would like to clear this kliyah.
I mean, okay, I wasn't mentioning this as, like, saying halach. I'm just pointing out that Baal is absent. I think you're making the point that Baal may be absent because it's impractical, and that's why the Mishnayos don't discuss it. But for the theoretical, you know, bases of how Yerushas HaBaal works, then the omission, we need to know what the halach is. So that's two ha'aros. And there's two other Gemaras that are very important for understanding Yerushas HaBaal. The first is a Gemara in Gittin on Daf Pehei, which discusses what types of exclusions, what type of rights a husband can retain when he divorces his wife. And it goes through a whole list of things. Can he retain the right to be mefer her nedarim, to annul her vows? Can he retain the right This is not in the Gemara, but the Rishonim discusses it. Can he retain the right to her income? Husband is entitled to his wife's income. Can he divorce her but retain his right to her income? Can he retain the right, let's say he's a Kohen, so by dint of his marriage or her marriage to him, she's permitted to eat truma. Can he retain the right to continue giving her truma even though she's no longer married to him? And the Gemara has a list of possibilities that all are along that vein. One of those possibilities, can he divorce her and retain the right to be Yorish her? In the Lashon of the Gemara, it's in the second line here, fifth to last word. This chutz mirusha seich mach. He says, I'm divorcing you with the exception of your Yerusha, I will still inherit you. What's the halacha? And the way the Gemara phrases the two possibilities, he says, number one, the nisuin haloshir, that there's nothing that's being retained of the actual nisuin. Odilma, says the Gemara, lishero viarash osaksev. It says, lishero viarash osa, and therefore something. Rashi explains that because Yerusha is one of the functions of She'ero, he only inherits her if she is his She'er. So therefore, the fact that he retains the right of inheritance indicates that he still is her She'er, that she is still his She'er. And that perhaps is going to nullify the entire divorce, because it's contradictory. He's sending her away, he's saying, you're no longer my wife, and yet he's saying, I'm retaining the right to your inheritance, you're still my She'er. So that's mutually contradictory. Being his wife and not being his wife, and yes, being his she'er, are at odds with one another. And, or perhaps, in the first possibility of the Gemara, is that these two are not necessarily at odds with one another, presumably because being a person's wife and being a person's she'er are two separate things. There are two dimensions of marriage, probably even more based on this Gemara. And being a she'er is not necessarily dependent on being a wife that needs to be mutar but geirishin, that needs to, you know, that now they have to marry somebody else. So this is an important Gemara in terms of Yerushas Habal and how much that integrates with the general central, you know, ideas of marriage, which the Rambam says in the beginning of Hilchos Ishos is basically comes along with the Isser, with the Chiyuv Misa for a woman who's Mizana, and comes along with the necessity for a get. Those, let's say, are the core of all of marriage. And how much is the She'er status and the Zechus of Yerusha grouped together with those in the core of what marriage is? And how much is it on the periphery, on the other, you know, extreme, that one can separate the, you know, the Isser and the penalty for his Nus from the Zechus Yerusha? A second important Gemara is in Arachin Daf Chafhei Amud Beis.
Wait, before you go on, can I just ask you, what do you mean by the word She'er? Can you explain that?
It's what the Gemara, the Pasuk says, She'ero. She'ero v'rash v'sa. Whatever the Gemara means, that's whatever the Pasuk means. You want to know what my guess is about what She'er is?
I mean, you're speaking about a contrast. You said She'ero versus marriage, right? So I just don't understand the difference. Can you explain the difference?
There are many, I think, many different dimensions of marriage. The Gemara itself over here, just to pick one example, talks about the aspect of marriage, which is called Kinyan Kasvo. A Kohen's wife is permitted to eat truma because she's considered his Kinyan Kasvo. So that's one dimension of marriage. It's Kinyan Kasvo. But we know, let's say, there are other dimensions also. There's what they call a Kinyan Ishos, which may or may be something else. I think that She'ero may indicate like a more, let's say better. Marriage, I think, is more contractual and more sociological in sense. The requirement of a get and the penalty for a woman who's Mizana, those may stem sort of from a contractual or
legal,
or legal,
okay,
know, dimensions
and
of
how
marriage.
Would you describe She'ero?
I think is more a function of physical or emotional closeness.
Yeah, I mean, the Rashbam brought his raya from the word She'er Ksusanon. L'chor he's learning like the Ramban and Chumash.
That She'ero comes from the word She'er Ksusanon?
Rashbam brought that as a raya. So the Ramban and Chumash says it means basically it's a mice of marriage. The ishus, the basic physical part of the relationship.
Uh-huh. So marriage relationship. That's what you mean by She'er.
I don't think that I would like those words. I think they're too vague for me.
Okay, so which words would you pick?
Meaning if I were to define the concept of share.
Uh-huh.
1 second.
Family. How much do you like share a view who share use this word family? Sort of what?
Yeah, but that's not what the bomb brings.
I'm just pointing out the way the Chumash uses share in general.
The extension of the person.
Extension of the person.
I'll give this is off the cuff a little bit, but I would say that it's the quality of having been one physical entity at one point, or the quality of having combined to produce or attempt to produce a physical entity that's a combination of both of them. I think that would probably just intuitively be the definition of share that comes closest to the way that it's used in Tanakh.
Okay.
So that's the physical, right?
Is that what you mean? Like that?
Yeah, I think that that's the closest.
Okay, fine.
It's more like it's different than the sociological dimension of marriage. It's different, you know, than the legal dimension of marriage. It's a different dimension. I think if you pin me down on it, that's the direction that I would move in terms of identifying it. But at present, I don't really have enough evidence one way or another to identify it by words other than that which the Psukim or the Gemara uses to identify it. So the second Gemara which is relevant is in Arif and Daf Kafei, and this is following a little bit on what the Gemara discussed on Kuf Tes and Kuf Ches about the redemption of a Stei Achuza. Let's say that a woman owns a Stei Achuza, an ancestral field that she got from her ancestors from the times of Yeshua bin Nun, and she pledges it to Hekdesh. So if she redeems the field, then she keeps it in perpetuity. However, if the Gizbarim, the treasurers of Hekdesh, sell that field to somebody else, then when Yovel comes around, the Kohanim get the field. The Gemara says that there is one exception between her redeeming it and somebody else purchasing it, and that is sort of the next of kin. And the question is, we know for certain the Gemara had discussions, who is the next of kin of a man who pledges his Stei Achuza to Hekdesh? We say it's clearly his son. It's not even his daughter, because the son precedes the daughter for Nachala. But what about by a woman? Who is her next of kin who's permitted to redeem the Stei Achuza? Do we say that it's also her son, just like a man? Or do we say her husband, because the husband precedes even the son for Yerusha? That's the Gemara Shaila, Boy Rebbe Zera. Isha, mi ma'amid la sadeh. Who is ma'amid the field for her? Who keeps it up for her and doesn't allow it to escape to the Kohanim when Yovel comes? And the two possibilities of the Gemara are, number one, ba'al mukim la, does the husband do this for her? Shekein yarsha, because the husband inherits her. He is the first in line to inherit. Odilma ben mukim la, shekein notel b'ra'oi kibumokzak. Or perhaps the son does it because the son is notel b'ra'oi kibumokzak. And the Gemara concludes teku. It's uncertain. As an aside, the Kesef Mishneh has a different version of this Gemara, which is relevant to Rabbi Harbsman's question from earlier, so I'll mention it as a Maimar HaMuskar. The Kesef Mishneh suggests that maybe it's clear for sure that the son is considered next in line, and the Safik only is whether the husband is considered next in line. So even though the husband is first in line for Yerusha, the son is clearly closer in line when it comes to redeeming Stei Achuza, which ought to be a clear indication that somehow or other the Ben is still the closest to his mother, even though he skipped over in terms of Yerusha. In terms of the Safik of the Gemara, according to the version that we have, it seems we know that the criteria for Stei Achuza is who's considered Acher. Imlo yigas asadev imachar asadev leish Acher. Another man, a different person. So who's considered Acher? So to this, do we say that the Baal is considered Acher because he's not Notel Bira'ui? Or is the son considered Acher because the son is not Yobisher? It's a question, meaning not a question of She'er and Ishus, who is Acher and who is not Acher? As, also as an aside, what this just reminds me of is the Gemara says on Daf Kof Tesvav or so that Ben is not Acher. So maybe that supports the Kesef Mishnah. Ben is not considered Acher because a bra, kara, di'ime, a son is like the leg of his mother, they're one.
There's a sign on the Gemara.
There are four deals.
I know, but the Gemara seems to be arguing part about that point.
Right, I bring other sources over, but that's a machlokas between Tosfos and the Balamor and the Rambam and the Rashba about whether we apply brachah d'ime earlier in the Sukkah. So that's just, this is two sfikos in the Gemara that seem to deal with Yerushas Habal and this question about Gerushin and the question about Steachuza, and the question seems to be how much is, well, there are two separate questions, but they both bear on the status of Yerushas Habal. I want to turn next to an analysis of three Rambams, which are pointed out by Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. The Rambams are situated in the context of Masne al Mashakasa B'Torah, a person who makes a Tanai, makes a condition, and that condition uproots what's written in the Torah. It's a complicated sugya in its own right, so I just want to make a couple of assumptions for the time being. When you get to Kuf Chavav, then you can challenge all those assumptions. Assumption number one that I want to make is that when we talk about Masne al Mashakasa B'Torah, it's not necessary for there to be a formal if-then statement. Masne al Mashakasa B'Torah simply means saying, I want to dispense with a certain rule in the Torah. So if a person says, I don't want to keep Hilchos Shabbos anymore, that's Masne al Mashakasa B'Torah. And the rule is, Tana'o Batel. It doesn't work. A person can't just uproot and discard something which is written in the Torah. However, when it comes to Davar Shebimamun, when it comes to a monetary matter, a person can, with the consent of all those who are negatively impacted by this, can uproot something which is written in the Torah. So let's say that a person wants to uproot his obligation to feed his wife, to give his wife mizonos. So he can say, with your consent, I hereby annul and discard the obligation to give you mizonos. And if she consents, then he no longer is obligated to give her those mizonos. So by Dvar Isser, like Shabbos, Masna Mashakasa B'Torah Tana Ubatel, but by Dabar Shalmamun, with the consent of everybody who's negatively impacted, it's Kayim.
There isn't a machlokas, that's a machlokas of Man of Yehuda, right?
Correct. We go according to Psak, which is this.
Okay.
The Dabar Shalmamun to Noah Kayim.
Okay.
However, there seems to be an exception to this rule of Dabar Shalmamun to Noah Kayim. And that is what the Gemara in Bava Metzia calls Lo Yada de Kamachil. And the definition of Lo Yada de Kamachil literally means he doesn't know enough for him to be mochil. If the person is being negatively impacted by this uprooting of a Torah law, if he doesn't know enough, if there's enough uncertainty involved, so then he can't muster up enough intellectual strength to truly be mochel with Lev Shalom. So that's what's called Lo Yada de Kamachil. And there's a discussion, I want to contrast three pieces of the Rambam, two in which he seems to define it one way, and the third where he defines it another way. Just look at the three Rambams and we'll figure out what exactly do they have in common and how do they differ. So again, the first Rambam says as follows. Let's dispense with reading it inside. The basic halacha is if a person lends money to his friend, and when a person loans money, so there's a condition that when Shemitah comes around, the loan is annulled. What if he says, I don't want Shemitah to annul this loan. I want Shemitah to come around, and you'll have to pay the loan back, even after Shemitah. So the Rambam says, in such a case, it's a valid condition. He can uproot the power of Shemitah to annul this loan. So that seems to follow the rule by Dabar Shevim Mamun. It's a monetary matter. The person who ordinarily would gain from Shemitah's nullifying the loan is not being, you know, is consenting to this. So it goes through. It's totally valid. The second case is about Onah. It's forbidden for a person to overcharge more than a certain amount. And what happens if he sells an object and he says, look, I don't know how much the object is worth. It could be that the amount that you're paying is exactly what it's worth. In which case, I'm not asking you to forgive me anything. But it could also be that whatever it is that you're paying is more than it's worth. In which case, I'm asking you to forgive the loan. So I'm selling you this item on condition that if there is onah, if I'm overcharging you, that you're mochel it. And that, the Rambam says, does not go through. It does not work. And the third case is by Yerushas HaBaal. It says, let's say that a husband is married to his wife, and he says, I don't want to be Yorish anymore. I want to give up or discard my right to inherit you. So, again, the Rambam says that if not for a special Gzeiras HaKasov, if not for a pasuk that says Chukas Mishpat, then this Tanai would take effect. Just like the Tanai of Shemitah would take effect. However, the pasuk says Chukas Mishpat, that sort of removes Nachla, or at least removes Yerushas HaBaal from the realm of regular Davar Shevim Mamun, and tells us that the Tanai does not go through, and that he's not able to annul or to defer the Yerusha from his wife. And just also as an aside, what the Rambam brings in Chukas Mishpat does not appear anywhere in our Girsaos of the Gemara. However, if one looks at the Meiri on Daf Kuf Kavav, the Meiri brings down such a girsa as applying to all of Yerusha, all of Nachla in general, that it's considered Chukas Mishpat, and therefore that one can never do away with Nachla by the mechanism of Yitnai. So essentially what we have is that, leaving aside the Gzeiras HaKasov for a second, but within the regular rules of Masna Al-Mash HaKasov B'Torah, B'Davar Shev B'Mamon, the case of Shemitah and the case of Yerusha, the Tanai will go through, as opposed to the case of Onah, where the Tanai will not go through. So at this point, I'll just throw out the question, what accounts for this distinction between the cases?
But in the case of the Onah, right, the Rambam himself that you just quoted here says that's only stam, but Mefarish, he says it does work, right?
Correct.
So, can you first explain that? What's the difference
between
Stam and Mefarish?
When he's Mefarish and he says that this object is worth $50 and I'm charging you $500,
okay,
and I'm asking you to accept this and be mochel to me.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's considered yada. He knows exactly how much he's being overcharged, and he's mochel.
Uh-huh.
The only difficulty seems to be when he's uncertain about whether his mechila is really necessary or whether his mechila is unnecessary.
Isn't that
or
a special din in Onoah?
Right.
I'm not sure I like the other ones. He's
right.
It's a special din in Onoah. It's Mamon. You need a mechila.
You need a
Gnuris
Das, right. But let's take the case of the loan, right? Or the Shemitah case,
yes,
right? Over there, we're dealing with a very specific loan, right? We're not talking about all loans
he
under
didn't
the sun.
Shemitah doesn't work.
Right.
He said,
just for this loan, I want Shemitah to be
Mishamit.
Right.
Not
so
for every sale.
So Tanai Shevim Mamon works.
Right. I mean, in both cases, we should say Tanai Shevim Mamon should
work.
No, he said Stam. He didn't
say.
Saying
by Onoah, it doesn't work because he's saying it doesn't have what it takes
right
to be Molecho.
So by Shemitah also, it doesn't have what it takes to be Mochel. Let me explain why.
Yeah.
Because by Onah, what's going on? He doesn't know whether his Tanai is actually going to come into effect and push aside
right
the Din D'Oraisa of Onah, or whether his Tanai is going to sit on the sidelines because there's no Din D'Oraisa to be pushed away.
Right.
But the same thing for Shemitah. He doesn't know whether his Tanai is going to come into effect and push aside the koach of Shemitah to be Mevatel alone, or whether his Tanai is going to be on the sidelines because the guy's going to pay him back before Shemitah.
May pay him back before. Okay,
no,
but there's
Shemitah,
an easy chiluk. You could say when it comes to the case of Onah, the amount is an integral part of the Din Onah. If you don't know how much he's overcharging you, then you cannot go ahead and create a mechila on that. because the amount is crucial. But when it comes to Shemitah, whether the guy will pay you back or not is not important. The fact that you're creating that setup, the mechanism, is the mechila. So therefore, the mechila will be active, and you just have to activate it. But the mechanism is meaningful. It's a defined mechanism. But when it comes to Ona, it's not a defined mechanism because you don't know the amount.
Okay, so let's just take it for a second. Again, we're positing now that there's a critical difference between Ona and Halval, that by Ona, so the price is critical, and therefore not knowing the price really is going to...
Someone in the das for the mechila.
As opposed to by a halva, where shmita exists one way or another.
You know everything except a certain metzias.
Right. It's a trigger. Think of it, paying back is like a trigger. It's like a tonight. That's what I'm saying.
An event in the future will
right.
happen or not.
Right. Right.
Let me ask you a question. According to your criteria, what would be the halacha in the third case? How would you describe Yerushas Habal? And is Yerushas Habal more similar to Ona, or is it more similar to Halva?
Like the whole book. What's the problem over there? He doesn't know who's going to die. That's like just an event in the future, but... Otherwise, he should be able to be most for the Yerusha. He knows what it is. Whatever she has, she has. He says, I'm not interested in it. I don't know who's going to die first, whatever. That's just mikra. That's like with the Shemitah. He'll pay back. He won't pay back ahead of time.
And how do you know that? Meaning, okay, so let me take a step back. Tell me if I'm getting what you're saying correctly, but this is the analogy that I wanted to use. Okay? Let's say that a person... It's Shabbos time, and he wants to trap a fly on Shabbos.
He wants to trap a fly.
Right? He wants to be over on the Malacha of Tzad.
Right.
So he finds a nice box. And he closes the lid of the box.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't know whether there's a fly in the box or whether there's no fly in the box.
Okay, so it's a toss. Okay,
it's not a psikrisha. I'm just using it as a mashal.
That's a suffix psikrisha. That's
not
classic.
It's not a suffix psikrisha.
No, that's the famous Taz where you don't know if there's a fly in the box and you close the box. That's called secretion of Mafrei. Okay, no.
I'm using it as a mashal.
No, so what's your point?
It would parallel the case of Ona. In the case of Ona, so he's basically saying maybe there is Ona in the box and maybe there's no Ona in the box. Maybe by closing the box I'm trapping the Ona. Maybe by closing the box I'm not trapping the Ona. I don't know. At the moment that I'm doing my action, so it's unclear to me whether this action will either have an effect from now and forever,
right,
or whether the action will not have an effect from now and forever.
Okay.
As opposed to, let me give a second case, which is more parallel to the case of Halva, and maybe to the case of Yerushas Habal.
Yeah.
Over there, let's say a person wants to cook a roll on Shabbos.
Mm-hmm.
So he puts dough into the oven. And he doesn't know whether somebody's going to take the dough out of the oven before it gets cooked, in which case he won't get the malacha. Or maybe someone will leave it in the oven until it gets cooked, in which case he'll get the malacha. So, in such a case, it's a very different state of uncertainty, meaning it's not a question of either I'm causing something for now and forever, or I'm not causing anything ever. Here it's clear I'm setting myself on a trajectory for something to happen, but something can come in and cut off that trajectory before
like
it reaches
that.
Its completion.
Okay,
so again, to bring the analogy back, by Ona, either there is Ona right now or there's no Ona right now. I'm not creating a trajectory. It could be that something starts off. It could be that nothing starts off.
Right.
As opposed to by the halva, by the loan, I'm creating a trajectory of Shemitah not interfering.
Right.
Now, it could be that somebody's going to prevent this trajectory from reaching its fulfillment by paying me back before Shemitah, in which case it'll never be invoked, it'll never be called into play.
Right.
The same thing by Yerushas Habal.
Right.
I'm creating a trajectory which says that I'm not going to get the Yerusha. I don't know whether this trajectory is ultimately going to be fulfilled and I'm going to need my Tanai to be the back of the Yerusha, or whether it won't.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So that's, I think, what the simplest distinction would be between the case of Ona and the cases of Yerushas Habal and of Halval.
What if it would sell it?
So this just leads me also mention as an aside that Reb Chaim seems to have a different chat about what exactly is the distinction. He doesn't see it as so clear that it's a matter of sort of right now, yes or no, versus a matter of, you know, right now you're doing something, and it's just a question whether it's going to be, you know, cut off. He seems to view it more as a question of how critical is it, how critical is what I'm being masnet to be oker to the definition of the transaction of the maisa that's taking place. He says, I buy a case of, let's go backwards, by Yerushas HaBaal, he says, he invokes this Gemara in Gittin, which says, puts me Yerushas say, there's a possibility that it's a shiur in the Ishus. He says, oh, that clearly tells you that there's such a thing as Ishus that comes together with Yerusha. That's standard Ishus. And then, I mean, even though the Yerusha itself is deferred until somebody passes away, but the creation of a marriage with the potential for the husband to inherit his wife, it is itself one type of marriage, and cutting that potential out is creating a change here and now, a definite change. It's either a marriage with potential for the husband to inherit his wife, or it's a marriage without such potential. So it's a change which is here and now, not even a trajectory. It's that you're being masneh, right, to for certain to be okir something that's in front of you. You're being masneh to for sure annul this particular, you know, detail of marriage.
For sure, I mean, you don't even know who's going to die first. Nothing to for sure.
It is for sure, because if you didn't know who's going to die first, says Reb Chaim, it would be just like the case of Onav.
I mean, you know she's dying first.
You don't know, but the fact is like this. We treat the possibility of his being yoreish her as a certainty. We say that there's such a thing as a marriage with this possibility, with this right, and a marriage without this right.
Maybe that's what he's saying. It means you have a schus right now. So you have that schus right now. It's one of the schusim that he has. So there's something definitely right there.
Correct. Precisely.
Okay.
Precisely. And by halva,
but you see, that depends on assuming that's what Yerusha Zabal is.
If
it started out earlier from, you know, Cher, it's not like that.
Meaning,
where does the Baal come in that he's the Yarush of Isha? If you're saying it's a schus Isha, so you can say what Reb Chaim is saying, that he has a body schus.
So let me expand what you're saying in two different ways. Number one, Reb Chaim is ignoring the other possibility in the Gemara in Gittin. The Gemara seems to say that it's possible to have a woman who's divorced from her husband, right, but at the same time, whose Yerusha, whose legacy goes to her husband. So Reb Chaim clearly is ignoring that. He's ignoring that possibility. Because according to that possibility, then Yerusha is not something which is definitional to the marriage, and it's something which is peripheral to the marriage, in which case it should be more similar to Onah. And a person should not be able to be masneh with his wife, to be okay that possibility. Right, so he does seem to be. And then, second of all, maybe what you mean is that based on what we said earlier, that there's a difference between she'er, right? And it's also the other possibility, essentially, that she'er is not the same thing as being married. It's one dimension of marriage, but not the core of marriage. And then creating a marriage without she'er may not really be being oker, but that still is not going to work. Meaning, she'er is.
I'm just saying, where do you say it's the Baal is a yorish? How do you know he's yorish? What's the pshat in his being yorish? Schus ishus. So it's vaday. It doesn't matter who's going to die first, but he has a schus vaday to be yorish.
So that's what I'm trying to say. It's not a kashrut.
No, it's not a kashrut. I'm just saying the other possibility. Chaim is assuming like Rambam, but if you didn't assume like that, like the way the Rashbam and Tosfos seems to say, you know, you may not want to say like that. You say what was being suggested otherwise.
You know, you're saying like this that if it's not a zechus ishos, but rather it's a din
share. Share both.
Well, we haven't.
It means that they're so close. It's basically. It's almost like it's him. So he's Yorish himself.
So maybe that's what he means. That it's a zechus ishos.
No. No, zechus ishos means like you get a. There's a lot of things you get when you get married. It's the contractual part. You have zechusim. You have chiyuvim.
But he's invoking the pasuk, the Gemara in Gittin, which invokes the pasuk of kiyum l'she'iro. So it seems that he's focusing on the she'er dimension. She'er for him proves that Yerusha Sabal is critical to marriage.
Gemaras, I mean, he tell me he quoted one, he didn't quote the other half of the Gemara. So I don't know. Like that, I'm not holding him to say. But the Yisod in the Rambam, I can assume he assumes. And the Rambam is the favorite. So it's clear. The Rambam brings it all up there in the middle of the Sulusa issue.
And that's a separate deal. Meaning, yes, again, we take a step back and put in a very big Maimara Muskor over here. So I'll say as follows. The Rambam, right, when he brings down the halachos of a husband inheriting his wife, where would you expect those halachos to appear? Would you expect them to appear together with, in Sefer Mishpatim, together with Hilchos Nachlos? Or do you expect them to appear in Sefer Noshim together with Hilchos Ishos? Where would you guess that those halachos would appear?
I would say Nachlos, for sure.
Yeah, you would have said Nachlos.
Because it's a function of forms like any other form of Yerusha. Right. The question who gets it.
Right.
And he doesn't.
I mean, the Rambam puts it in Hilchos Ishos,
right,
which suggests that it may not be a regular form, right, of Nachlos. You put that together with the fact that it's really, it really doesn't come up in the Parak in the context of the other lists of Nachlos. The Shulchan Aruch also, by the way, does not put it in in Choshen Mishpah, which is where we go if we're a part of Nachlos, but he rather puts it in Eben HaEzer, which is, again, Dinim in Ishos. And it's all part of a gigantic bracket. I'll just make you a quick list of 9 or 10 different areas in which Yerusha Sabal differs from regular Yerusha, either certainly or passively, which may suggest that it's qualitatively different from regular Yerusha in some way or other. What's the list? It's not that I didn't make this list up myself, I just found it in different Achronim. So I'll go through as follows. First of all, you have this last Rambam on the list. The Rambam says, Hisne imah shelo yiroshena. If a husband makes a tanai with his wife that he doesn't want to inherit her, hareza lo yiroshena. So that tanai, it works. Even though we know, just as that a person can never be masne, right, to just not inherit from his father, or to not inherit from his brother. It just doesn't work. There is actually an interesting theoretical discussion in Rishonim about whether, let's say, that a fetus had the ability to talk. So let's say that this fetus were to tell us that it doesn't want to inherit its father. So then there's a machlokas Rishonim. I think the Yad Ramah says that it would work, and other Rishonim say it wouldn't work. But the Pashtos, a child can never distance himself from the inheritance. It comes to him whether he wants it or not. So there's a concrete difference between a husband and any other Yorish. A husband can basically say, I don't want it at some point, whereas other Yorishim cannot. It says, Aval ochel peirus b'chayeha. Whatever, that's separate. Then he says another halacha. The chayin, im hisne ima, sheyirash miksas nechaseha. If he makes a tanai, that he should only get some of the nechasim and not other nechasim. So hakol kayom, says the Rambam, it's a valid tanai. So this is also another interesting discussion, whether, let's say, by Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, who says that you're allowed to reapportion the estate and give more to one son and less to another son, and that it works. So Rabbi Yochanan has a chakira, and one of the tzadim of the chakira is that maybe pshat is, and this is the opinion of some Rishonim, that all that you're able to do is you're able to declare this person is more of a Yorish, this person is less of a Yorish. This person is a Yorish, this person is not a Yorish. This person is a Yorish. So if that's the case, you can't really do it l'chatzon. You can't do it by hands. You can't say, well, he's a Yorish on these properties, on these assets, and not a Yorish on those assets. Either you're declaring him more Yorish on more, or you're declaring him Yorish on less. I think that some Achronim point to this, that you can say, well, he can say, I'm not getting some and I'm getting others. That's also an indication of something where Yerusha Sabal differs from regular Yerusha. Regular Yerusha, you can't basically say, I'm opting out of some, or I'm opting into some and opting out of others. It's all or nothing, according to some. And here it seems to be clear that it's not all or nothing. It's part and part.
But I mean, this is not just the Rambam. I mean, he's just quoting the Gemara. The Rambam is just paskening like the Mishnah in Ksuvos, right?
Yes.
So I'm just saying, going back to this Rav Chaim that we talked about, if you try to fit it into this Chakira, whether it's a din in She'ero or whether it's a din in Schus, so if you say it's a din in Schus, then it makes sense, Alpisvara, that a husband can just prevent it, right? But if you say it's She'ero, how can the husband do that? I mean, like, if it's automatic, that's part of marriage, how can you just break that She'ero? How can you make a T'nai on She'ero? You can't make a T'nai on She'ero, right? What is he saying?
He's not they're not beforehand.
So what? I mean, She'ero is a reality. I mean, is it subject to T'nai? It's not a double Shabbat Mammon, right? So how can you possibly do this if you're saying that Yerusha Sabal is a function of She'ero?
My guess would be that, again, here I'll also say there's an interesting machlokas I use as a mashal, machlokas between Rabbi Lichtenstein and Rabbi Parnas. Let's just pick a name out of the hat. Right, so this is the question. When you have a piyot on Rosh Hashanah, and we say Maaseh Elokeinu, and then we say Maaseh Bnei Adam. So you have divine handiwork and human handiwork. So which of the two is, you know, more, I don't know, call it more interesting or stronger? This is an interesting question that can be investigated in many areas of halacha, human handiwork versus divine handiwork. So essentially, Yerusha, ordinary Yerusha, between a father and a son, or a father and brothers and uncles and grandparents, etc., is all basically, it's like divine handiwork. Now, Kadosh Baruch Hu says, you know, when you're born, that this is who you're family is. It's not a matter of choice. You're born into the family. God sends a soul down into this family, and that's the family that it belongs to.
Okay.
As opposed to when you have husband and
artificial,
wife. So
right?
It's artificial. It's Ma'isei de Adam. Uh-huh. There's She'eros, but She'eros is not the same thing necessarily as Kurva.
Natural.
It may end up in the same place. It could be that just like a father and a son are considered Basar Echad, right? They're one entity. And a husband and a wife are considered also Basar Echad. V'hayu l'basar echad, they're one entity. But the former, father and son, that's God's decree that a father and a son are one family. But a husband and a wife, meaning it could be there's a bas call that goes out 40 days before, without getting into those, you know, issues of, you know, hashkacha in shiduchim, but it seems to be, at least the way that it appears to people, that it's a matter of choice.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say another difference. The Ramah in Masechta Sanhedrin mentions that from the perspective of observers, it would seem, he says, it seems to people that the bond between a father and a son, or between relatives who share blood or genes or whatever you want to call it, it appears to people to be stronger than the bond between a husband and wife. And the Ramah points to, and it's a totally different context, the context of Eidos, and what's the difference between a Baldavar and a Karov. He says basically that people look at marriage as being a weaker bond because it can be dissolved. Right, so meaning this is not, may not be the way that the genesis of marriage may not be the reason for its weakness and for the Yerusha that results from that as being weaker, but rather it could be that the precariousness, it's not a fun word to use about marriage, but the fact that there's a capability of dissolving it, there's no way of dissolving a family, but a marriage can be dissolved, so at least in Jewish law, so marriages can be dissolved. So that may also be something which renders all of the mamonos or the Yerusha consequences of marriage weaker than other ordinary forms of Yerusha. And it may not be because the yisod of being basar echad and of being she'er is different. It could just be because of the way that it came about and because of its endurance or the potential for its permanence or impermanence. Those both may contribute towards its being weaker. Just in terms of meaning, you can get it. I mean, even if you say that Yerusha Sabal is because of She'er, like the Gemara, you know, seems to indicate, again, just also as an aside, She'er is not the only source for Yerusha Sabal. There are 7 or 8 different sources. She'er is only one source. The Gemara in Gittin quotes that source. If you use the other sources, so then you may end up with a different model entirely. But so those two things may contribute to make it weaker. And what are some other differences?
So just, go ahead, don't worry.
Again, going through this list. Pick 2 or 3. So there's the Ar Sameach. has the following suffix. You know, if a person is owed money, and he has a shtar chov, says that I owe you money, and then you sell that shtar chov to Rabbi Balsam. So now you have the capability of being mochel the chov, even though you no longer own the chov, but you're able to be mochel the chov. And not only that, but your yarshim, right, are able to be mochel the chov as well. So the arshim says, I'm not sure what the halacha is, but if a woman sells the chov, does her husband have the right to be mochel that chov? Meaning, in other words, is he a regular yoresh? Meaning, the same way that a son would be a yoresh who has the right to be mochel the chov, or maybe he's not a regular yoresh. Maybe he's also like someone just tangential who happens to get the money, but he's not necessarily a regular yoresh. That's one issue. Let's say another issue is whether, just like the Gemara discusses, whether the zechus habal to inherit his wife can exist after the marriage is dissolved. So the Rashbam apparently has a possibility that the zechus yerusha can go away even before the marriage is dissolved. Just like we find certain other things, kima shenasan ein of legarsha. Once the husband decides that he wants to divorce her, so he no longer gets the rights to her, the payros of her nechassim. So the Rashbam says maybe also he doesn't have the rights to her yerusha anymore once he's decided to divorce her. Another possibility that indicates, again, like the Gemara and Gittin, but independently of that suffix over there, that maybe the characteristic or the character of Yerusha Sabal is different than other Yerushas. And as Rabbi Harvestman and Rabbi Volsam alluded to before, the classical way of posing it is whether it's a Zechus Mamon, that it's just like he gets a Zechus to her Maisi Adayim, so he gets a Zechus to her Yerusha, or whether it's a Din in Yerusha, that it's not just like a Zechus Mamon, that he gets, you know, has a right to inherit her, but rather that he becomes like her relative to inherit her. I think that based on some of what we did, we can sort of eliminate that clear and firm distinction and replace it maybe with other distinctions that focus more on the characteristics of Yerusha Sabal rather than on different names on which it's called. And that's some of the importance of what we've just done. You can call it a name. You can call it a name that they're Basar Echad. You can call it a name that it's Zechus Mamon. You can call it a name that it's Din and Ishos. But at the end of the day, everything should get back to the characteristics. The halachos need to be resolved based on the characteristics. Again, just to bring everything full circle. So then we have the suffix of the Gemara and Gittin about whether Yerusha can go beyond Yishos. Reb Chaim said that maybe the tzad that it can't go beyond Yishos indicates that it's really fundamentally part of marriage. But what does it mean to be fundamentally part of marriage? So is it a Zechus Mamon which is fundamentally part of marriage? Is it the status of She'er which is fundamentally part of marriage? That's unclear. We had the suffix in Arachin, which seems to indicate that it could be that even though the husband is the first in line to be Yoresh, but the son is still considered more primary, he's less acher with regard to his mother than the husband is to his wife, which also may seem to indicate again that at least when it comes to defining groups of people, that it could be that the son and the mother are considered more one entity than the husband and wife. And again, maybe pshat over there is because that's a familial, it's a relationship which is not artificial, it's natural, so therefore they're considered one, and it can't be dissolved, as opposed to the husband and the wife. Maybe that's what determines for acher. We had these three Rambams. The question was, what exactly is it that allows there to be masne on masakasav b'torah by Yerushas Habal? And it seems that there were two different suggestions for what's planned over there. One was that we create a trajectory. Basically, that when the husband says, I don't want to be your issue, he's creating a trajectory that if for sure, unless something interferes with it, it will ultimately result in his not being your issue's wife, as opposed to, let's say, where there's no trajectory created. It's either something gets off the ground or not. That was our pshat. And then Reb Chaim had a different pshat where he said that Yerusha is a fundamental characteristic of the Nisuin, and therefore, when he's creating a Nisuin without Yerusha, he's actually creating an effect right now, even though meaning the effect is only the effect of either yes possibility or no possibility, but that's on paper, there's either one type of contract or another type of contract, as opposed to by onah, where it's not a matter of this contract versus that contract, it's either for sure or you know, for sure that there is an akira or for sure there's no akira. It's not a matter of for sure switching from this contract to that contract. Those and then we proceeded from there to just discuss some of the differences between Yerushas Habal and Yerushas Shar Yarshim based on the question about, you know, what exactly does it mean that if it's a function of Shar, how is it possible for you know, for the husband to forego his right? And again, the classical Chakir Bakronim, is it a Zichos Ishos? That's why it's a Zichos Ishos, or is it a Din Yoresh? And it's again, that's not 100% clear.
Okay, Scott.
Thank you very much.